Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Identity Theft Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Monday, May 4th, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Flores-Figueroa v. United States. In this case, the Supreme Court considered whether a criminal must have known that the ID he was using belonged to another person in order to be convicted of aggravated identity theft for, quote, knowingly using a means of identification of another person. In a decision delivered by Justice Breyer that drew no dissents, the court held that, following ordinary English grammar, the statute requires the government to demonstrate that the defendant knew the means of identification to belong to another person, thus reversing the Eighth Circuit decision below. To discuss the decision, we welcome Peter Jaffe. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Jaffe.
On May 4, 2009, the Supreme Court rendered a unanimous judgment in Flores-Figueroa v. United States. Justice Breyer delivered a majority opinion for himself and six other justices. Justices Scalia and Alito each offered an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. At issue was the interpretation of an aggravated identity theft provision, 18 U.S.C. Section 1028, majuscule A, minuscule A, 1. Which mandates a two-year sentence enhancement for anyone who, during and in relation to any felony violation enumerated in subsection C, knowingly transfers, possesses, or uses, without lawful authority, a means of identification of another person. The question was whether a defendant must know that the means of identification used belonged to another person. Defendant Figueroa was a citizen of Mexico illegally in the United States. In 2000, he presented forged Social Security and alien registration cards to his employer. The identification numbers on those documents did not belong to another person. In 2006, he presented new identification documents to his employer. This time, the documents listed his real name and used new Social Security and alien registration numbers. And this time, those numbers were already assigned. They belonged to real people. After the employer reported the suspicious activity, the government charged Figueroa with various illegal entry and identity fraud violations, to which he pled guilty. Additionally, the government charged Figueroa with aggravated identity theft, the charge at issue in this case. Figueroa argued that the statute should be read to require that a defendant know that the means of identification used belongs to another person. If such knowledge were required, then Figueroa could defeat this charge because he did not, in fact, know that the identification numbers were assigned to someone else. Figueroa justified the knowledge requirement with five arguments. These are my characterizations. I'll go through each argument. Argument A. Figueroa argued that the text and structure of the statute required applying the knowledge requirement to the ownership element. In normal usage, when one uses an adverb before a verb, it applies to the entire action, including direct objects. This is especially true with the adverb knowingly. For example, John knowingly discarded his sister's homework usually means that John knowingly discarded something and that John knew that it was his sister's homework. The government proposed supposed counterexamples. John knowingly discarded the homework of his sister. Here, the government claimed, the link between John's state of mind and the ownership of the homework was more tenuous. I think a better counterexample would have been John knowingly threw away the homework that his sister was going to turn in later that day. That sentence implies that John knew that it was his sister's homework, but does not fairly imply that he knew it would be turned in later that day. Much was made of this argument in the briefs, oral argument, and the opinions, and I would venture to say that this was the deciding factor in the case. At oral argument, Justice Scalia was keen on Figueroa's grammatical point as a general proposition, but Justice Alito was more skeptical. He emphasized the contextual nature of the inquiry. Justice Breyer's majority opinion bought this argument both as a statement of ordinary grammar and as applied to the statute, but stopped short of endorsing it as a general interpretive rule. The government mounted several counterattacks on Figueroa's textual argument. First, it offered a detailed and somewhat tenuous argument that if the court applied knowingly beyond the verbs of the statutory provision, it would have to apply knowingly beyond the verbs in a nearly identical neighboring provision. There, the knowingly requirement would create a surplusage problem. The details are complicated and unnecessary to recount, Suffice it to say that Justice Breyer's majority opinion easily resolved any potential surplusage problem. I found the government's point extremely tenuous, and I don't think it was necessary to address. However, the government did offer one argument that the majority ought to have addressed, and that argument is this. If Congress wanted to include a separate knowledge requirement, it could have done so explicitly. In fact, Figueroa pled guilty under a provision where Congress did include a separate knowledge requirement. Section 1546 minuscule A criminalizes the knowing transfer, possession, or use, without lawful authority, of the means of identification known to belong to another actual person. I think the contrast between the present provision and Section 1546 is a fair point, and I was disappointed that none of the Court's opinions addressed it. Argument B. Figueroa argued that the traditional understanding of theft required that a defendant know the property taken had belonged to someone else. He pointed to the 1952 case of United States versus Morissette. In that case, a statute prohibited the knowing conversion of U.S. government property. The defendant had taken some scrap metal from a field, thinking it abandoned. The court dismissed the charges against him because he did not know that the scrap metal belonged to another person, so he could not have intentionally converted it. The court did not address this argument, probably because the government adequately refuted it in its briefs. First, a citation of Morissette tends to work against the defendant, because the term of art conversion itself includes the requirement that the property belonged to another person. Thus, to knowingly convert, one would have to know that the property belonged to another. But in subsequent cases, the courts of appeals have made it clear that a defendant need not know that the property belongs specifically to the United States government. Therefore, the word knowingly there does not extend past the verb. Second, the government argued that analogizing to theft is simply a non sequitur, because the present statute does not criminalize theft. In fact, the term theft appears nowhere in the statutory language. It appears only as a heading, and that heading includes other provisions that it cannot possibly be read as theft. So the analogy is simply inapplicable. Argument C. Figueroa argued that there should be a general presumption that when Congress includes a mens rea requirement in a criminal provision, it should apply to all elements of the crime, making the conduct illegal. The government didn't fight very hard against this as a general legal principle, but instead claimed that it was inapplicable here. Mens rea requirements, it asserted, are only to be implied for elements of a crime separating illegal conduct from legal conduct. That is, mens rea should be implied to protect against statutes sweeping in seemingly legal conduct. Because this was a sentencing enhancement, there's no seemingly legal conduct. Figueroa knew that he was committing a crime. He just didn't know which crimes. The court agreed with Figueroa on this point, but without much explanation. Argument D. Figueroa submitted that a mandatory sentence enhancement for use of another's means of identification simply did not advance the purpose of the statute. The point of the statute was to punish the worst incidents of identity theft. But the present case indicates that there is no difference in culpability between the defendants who used numbers belonging to another person and numbers that did not belong to another person. The statute was intended to deter core identity theft, where the perpetrator sought to fleece people of their bank accounts, to corrupt their credit, or otherwise to steal something from the victim. The statute was not intended to capture conduct like Figueroa's, which did not apparently harm the true owner of the means of identification. Both Figueroa and the government spent a lot of time in their briefs on this argument, but the court seems to have been adequately persuaded that this provision criminalized theft, the hardcore deprivation of a victim's property. That simply wasn't the case here. The government further argued that Figueroa's interpretation would defeat the statutory purpose by impeding prosecutions. The court didn't buy this, simply because prosecutors have to prove intent all the time. They can always introduce circumstantial evidence, and that evidence often carries the day. It's no different here. Argument E. Figueroa argued that the rule of lenity cut in his favor. The rule of lenity dictates that when a criminal statute is ambiguous, that is, that there are two plausible interpretations, the court ought to choose the interpretation benefiting the criminal defendant. And this applies not only to substantive criminal law, but also to sentencing enhancements. Unfortunately, the rule of lenity has been mired in controversy for some time. What does it mean for a statute to be ambiguous? Maybe a statute is ambiguous only when there's a perfect tie. or maybe when there are multiple right answers, even if one is more likely than the other. When is ambiguity determined? Maybe it's at the beginning of the interpretive process, after looking at the text alone. Or maybe ambiguity is determined after the court has seized everything it could, every interpretive technique available. Dan M. Kahan has even argued that the rule of lenity ought to be abandoned. As a result, the rule of lenity has been clouded in recent years by a proliferation of formulations, each with subtle variations, and often presented in dicta. Not surprisingly, both Figueroa and the government sparred on the meaning of lenity, and not surprisingly, neither of them won. The justices considered lenity briefly during oral argument. Justice Scalia took his long-standing position that ambiguity is measured immediately after consulting the text. Justice Ginsburg seemed to offer an intuitively plausible position, that if courts of appeals are evenly split on an issue, it's probably ambiguous. But the oral argument did not focus on lenity, and none of the court's opinions explicitly addressed the rule or its application of Figueroa. Even Justice Scalia, probably the most ardent proponent of the rule of lenity, only hinted at the rule when he asserted the statute's text was unambiguous. Thus, we must infer that the rule of lenity is inapplicable in his view. As a result, the court held that the government must prove that the defendant knew that the means of identification used belonged to another person as part of a Section 1028 Majuscule A, Minuscule A, 1 prosecution. Before closing, I'd like to point out two interesting aspects of the Flores-Figueroa decision. First, the dissents of Justices Scalia and Alito are notable for their careful qualification on the majority's reasoning. In the majority opinion, Justice Breyer said, quote, "In ordinary English, where a transitive verb has an object, listeners in most contexts assume that an adverb, such as knowingly, that modifies the transitive verb, tells the listener how the subject performed the entire action, including the object as set forth in the sentence," unquote. This proposition clearly represents a major consideration for the majority's judgment. But I do not think it represents a generally applicable statement of law, and I doubt it constitutes a holding of the case. For one thing, it contains a variety of so-called weasel words, such as ordinary English, listeners in most contexts, and listeners assume. For another, by its own terms, the court is not making a pronouncement of law, but a descriptive statement about ordinary English usage. An ordinary usage, of course, is flexible and malleable, quite unlike a proposition of law. Later in the same section, the court takes pains to note that it is not stating a general rule, and the context is all important. Later, Justice Breyer states basically the same rule, only applied to criminal statutes. Quote, "Courts ordinarily read a phrase in a criminal statute that introduces the elements of a crime with the word knowingly as applying that word to each element," end quote. Again, I think it would be careless lawyering to take this as a general proposition of law. The word ordinarily deprives the proposition of any real bite, and the proposition is merely descriptive anyway. Nonetheless, both Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito wrote separately to emphasize that this proposition did not state a general rule of law, but that the application of this rule depends on context. Justice Alito specifically stated that he was afraid that some might misread the court's opinion. In my opinion, Justices Scalia and Alito were probably right to emphasize the limited nature of the court's holding, because advocates often seem to cite judicial language without any regard for context and with no concern for dicta. But it strikes me as a sad state of affairs when justices feel the need to insert such warnings to prevent careless lawyers from misconstruing the court's pronouncements. Second, I'd like to note one argument offered by the government, one that the court did not address. Figueroa had posited the traditional presumption that mens rea requirements apply to all of the elements of a crime. As evidence of this presumption, Figueroa cited several cases and the Model Penal Code. The government responded that Congress has legislated interpretive techniques in the past and offered the Dictionary Act as an example. The Dictionary Act provides a few definitions that are common to the rest of the United States Code. But Congress has not legislated with regard to interpreting mens rea requirements, nor has it endorsed the Model Penal Code. To include one thing is to exclude another, and therefore the court should not apply the presumption offered by Figueroa. Now, as I understand this argument, if Congress has not legislatively authorized a particular interpretive method, courts should not adopt it. That's really an extraordinary proposition. Nick Rosenkrantz has argued persuasively that Congress ought to get into the statutory interpretation game by prescribing interpretive methods. On the other hand, Matthew Frank at the National Review recently asserted that Congress could not constitutionally do so. But I think it's perfectly clear to everyone that Congress has not, merely by virtue of the scant provisions of the Dictionary Act, comprehensively legislated which interpretive methods courts can use. Taken to its logical conclusion, this reasoning would preclude most or all of the interpretive doctrine and literature currently on the books. In fact, it's hard to see what methods the courts could use when interpreting statutes until Congress legislates with respect to them. As a result, I find this argument quite surprising, and I'd be interested to see if it arises in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.